Well, welcome to the Tribal Theocrat Live Show. I'm Christian Gray, and we thank you again for joining us here at Saturday night, 10 p.m. You must have no life like us. Well, today, have a good guest on today, exciting show, talking about the subject of Christian apologetics, specifically the methodology of presuppositionalism. And I'll bring my guest on here in a minute. And you can join us in the chat room. Thank you for everybody there who is there and chatting. Please feel free to ask a question for our guest at any time, and we'll try to get to those at the top of the hour. I think also we're going to have a second guest call in and interact with Scott a little bit on some apologetic questions. And without further ado, we'll bring on the guest, Scott Terry. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Oh, no problem. I'm really honored.
Let's get into the subject of apologetics. First of all, tell our listeners, what is apologetics?
Oh, that's going to be pretty hard, because to even answer that question is going to launch us directly into a bunch of debate on the issue. And, it's a controversial topic, apologetics. And can I just say, though, before we start, I am not the Scott Terry that's, you know, the New York agrarian farmer, you know, and so I apologize to like 80% of your listeners who might be here looking for him. And that's a common mistake I get all the time.
Yeah.
So, I am not the Scott Terry that's the New York farmer. I'm just the Scott Terry from down south. So
Scott Terry, the New York farmer, has his own radio show. Is he weekly or is he biweekly? I know it's called, I think, Christian Northern Farmer.
I think he's weekly.
He's weekly. Good.
I believe so. But
yeah, I think he has
really
a Friday
good.
Night show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So apologetics. On the street, if you ask somebody what apologetics is, they're going to think that, you know, normally it means someone who is defending a position. You know, if you're an apologist, you are defending a position, right? Usually religious positions. And the word apologist, it doesn't mean that you're apologizing for something, right? It doesn't mean you're saying you're sorry. I get that a lot of times in debates. I'll talk to people and say, well, I'm a Christian apologist. And they say, well, what are you apologizing for?
Yeah.
But it's from the Greek word apologia. And really, in ancient Greece, they had these courts, and someone would – you know, the defendant would defend his position in public. The prosecutor would, you know, bring arguments against him, and the defendant would present an apologia. And so it's got a connotation of a formal defense in a court. And over the years, that took on Christian terms, specifically with Justin Martyr and all the like, the early Christian apologists. But that's what it basically means on the street, right?
Right.
In Christian circles, the word apologetics is hotly contested, as I've already said. There's a lot of different theories depending on what sort of theology you hold to.
Sure.
So some people think, well, what we need to do is we need to do apologetics with unbelievers, because they think of it as sort of an evangelistic outreach kind of thing, right? We're going to talk to these unbelievers, and we're going to pound the truth of Scripture into their heads, and we're going to win them for the gospel, you know. And that's a very popular conception of apologetics, unfortunately. By the way, that's not just on the streets. That's some fairly big thinkers in the world of Christian apologetics think this way. I mean, you got Francis Schaeffer, even the great B.B. Warfield, a Calvinist theologian. He thought that you did apologetics to lay the groundwork for your Christian theology. You do apologetics to start with, and then once the person can see that, Christianity is reasonable, then you build up to some sort of Christian truths. But I think that's wrong. In thinking about how to answer this question for you, it may be cliched, but there's the right way to do it. There's the wrong way to do apologetics. And then there's the way that, you know, Scott Terry does apologetics.
Okay. But at least at a at a bare minimum, apologetics is the reasonable defense of the faith, right?
Well, I don't think so anymore, honestly. And here's why. I hope you'll let me read from Dabney, because I think R.L. Dabney in the preface to his Defense of Virginia in the South really hammers home exactly what we're trying to do as Christian apologists. By the way, I am a Kenist. I am proud to be a Kenist. And I think that as a Kenist, we have unique obligations when it comes to apologetics. So as a Kenist, I look around the world and I see that we live in this god-awful democracy where pretty much everybody hates us. They hate us. And you're not going to be able to reason with these people. We'll get into this later, I'm sure, but according to the presuppositionalist writings, there's an ethical antithesis between the believer and the unbeliever. They are gnashing their teeth at God Almighty. And by the way, it's not just God. They know God through us, right? They look at us, they see, I believe specifically the European races, and they hate us because we reflect Him. And I got scripture here to prove this point if you want to hear it. I mean,
go for it.
Yeah, definitely. The main scripture I would appeal to would be 1 Peter 2:9, 9-12. Ye are an elect race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that ye might show forth the excellencies of Him who called you out of darkness. Now that is very important, that ye might show forth. We are called as a people, and we show forth God. So when people look at us as Europeans, I really believe they are seeing God because we're reflecting. Of course, it's not so much the case today, but at least in history, our people have reflected God. And we have other verses, John 15:18. The world hateth you. It has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you. But because you are not of the world, and I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you. So we're fundamentally different from the world. We're reflecting God's glory, and we're in the middle of a bunch of raving lunatics who want to kill us right now. So honestly, are we going to try to reason with them? Are we going to try to provide some sort of defense, intellectual justification? No, I don't think that's our goal as apologists. And I don't know, I'm getting a little long-winded here, but would you mind if I read a little bit from Dabney's preface?
I don't mind at all. We've got another 8 questions to go through, so it might be midnight before we wrap up. Exactly. I'm just teasing. Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
Very loud and clear. So, a discussion of a social order totally overthrown and never to be restored here will appear as completely out of date to them as the ribs of Noah's Ark bleaching amidst the eternal snows of Ararat, and to his posterity when engaged in building the Tower of Babel. I mean, that's exactly the situation we're in right now. But Dabney goes on. He says, let me distinctly premise that I do not dream of affecting the perverted judgments of the great anti-slavery party which now rules the hour. And they still rule, by the way. Of course, a set of people who make success the test of truth, as they avowedly do in this matter, and who have been busily and triumphantly engaged for so many years in perfecting a plain injustice to which they had deliberately made up their minds, are not within the reach of reasoning. Nothing but the hand of a retributive providence can avail to reach them. The few among them who do not pass me by with silent neglect, I am well aware, will content themselves with scolding. They will not venture a rational reply. So I think we're in the exact same state as Dabney was, and we cannot reason with these people. But Dabney goes on to say, I mean, obviously he wrote his entire book, you know, A Defense of Virginia in the South. So if he doesn't want to reason with them, well, then why is he writing his book? And in the same way, if we're apologists, you know, if we're not interested in reasoning with these people, well, what's our point in doing Christian apologetics? I think we have a unique answer to this as Kenists, and we should side with Dabney here. And one more last thing I'll read. The last and only office that remains to us, or to her sons, but to us, is to leave the testimony for her righteous fame, feeble It may be now amidst the din of passion and material power, yet indistinguishable as truth's own torch. History will someday bring present events before her imperial bar, and then her ministers will recall my obscure little book and will recognize it in the words of truth and righteousness attained by the signatures of time and events. We do apologetics to encourage the people around us and to silence the foolish talk of unbelief. It's a measure of warfare, of resistance against this satanic regime we live in. And I am very passionate about doing it, and I take it very seriously. And it is not some sort of premise to some sort of evangelistic outreach. And it's not a trendy intellectual game you play. This is serious business, and I get very passionate about it. But that's what apologetics is. It's silencing the foolish talk of unbelief and battling the powers of the air that we're all fighting against.
I like it. Thank you. Our friend in the chat room, naughty boy Justin Cottrell, says that his favorite apologist is Martin Luther King. So take that for what it's worth.
Well, he's got a dream, definitely.
He does have a dream. How did you get interested in apologetics, Scott?
Interesting story. I was in the military for a while, and I grew up in a very fundamentalist Christian household. I joined the military full of all these naive notions. I wanted to kill me some Muslims because Rush Limbaugh said I should kill Muslims, and I wanted to attain glory and honor. And I eventually ended up getting stationed downrange. I'm not going to say where, but there was a guy calling himself a Jewish anti-Christian missionary. And we would get in these arguments after, you know, after we had finished work or whatever. Everybody would be sitting around and having these discussions. And he just demolished everything I believed in. He said, well, Jesus never existed. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't write gospels. The Bible was never canonized properly. I mean, just on and on with all these Christ myth arguments. The Apostle Paul was a woman hater, racist, which today I'd be like, yeah, all right. But back then, this stuff just floored me. And so I started, you know, I went to the internet whenever I could. We didn't have internet all the time, but I went to it. And that's when I really got into apologetics. I found JP Holdings' website, tectonics.org. He is a wonderful evidentialist apologist. And Holding is all about, you know, the canonization process, the Christ myth arguments, the historicity of the New Testament narratives and the Old Testament narratives and harmonization of the Gospels and all that. That was apologetics. That was what apologetics was for me. I was memorizing all the supposed contradictions in Scripture. And long after I got back to the States, I just kept reading. I mean, this guy, I never really dealt with the Jewish anti-Christian missionary like I feel like I should have, but it started me on this intellectual process. And so I started going to conferences, and I eventually met J.P. Holding in real life. And if you guys have ever met J.P., he's kind of an interesting character. But at this conference, I met J.P., but the biggest thing was I heard a talk on something called presuppositional apologetics. And that changed my life and blew me away, and I haven't ever looked back since, frankly.
Now, who is the guy you just mentioned? J.P. who?
J.P. Holding.
I'm not really familiar with him.
James Patrick Holding. He's a librarian. He's got a degree in library science, but he's really good at, like, researching primary source data and all that. And he also draws cartoons. He's got a cartoon of Hal Lindsey as a walrus that's just hilarious. Ooh, yeah.
I have not heard of him. Interesting.
Yep. If you Google anything, like if you Google a contradiction or something, I mean, that's probably going to be one of the first sites you come to. It will either be Tectonics or Christian Think Tank or something like that. But you'll get to them really quick when you're, you know, if you're a desperate young kid looking for answers, you know, you're going to find him.
Sure. You mentioned presuppositionalism, and I understand that you're here not to talk about every apologetic methodology. You're here specifically to defend presuppositionalism. What are the other main schools of apologetics? Is every defense of the faith a good one, or some better than others?
There's ladies here, so I won't respond with the pejorative to that question.
You told me you would not say any curse words on the show.
Yeah, even though I might be tempted. There are various schools of apologetics. I think I would side with Dr. Greg Bahnsen, whom I'm sure we'll talk about more in a little bit. But Dr. Bahnsen kind of groups everything down into just two main categories. He calls one traditional apologetics, and the other is just presuppositional apologetics. But traditionally, people talk about classical apologetics, evidentialism, and things of that nature. But the idea is that these schools want to there's a sense in which it's not helpful to talk about different schools of apologetics because it's so ambiguous. It's really for just, I'm going to say this word a lot probably, but it's for pedagogical reasons. You know, I believe that I'm seeing a red ball. Well, there's all sorts of beliefs tied up in this. You have ballness, you have redness, you have, you know, the concept of personal identity. So all of these beliefs are tied together into one big system of beliefs. And this big system of beliefs is what we're talking about when we want to talk about a worldview. It's all encompassing. It touches on everything. And everybody has a worldview. Everybody has this structure of beliefs. So, yes, I there's questions about the word baldness in the chat room. probably not a good illustration.
I remember that when Bahnsen talked about worldview, he broke it down into the three main components of epistemology, metaphysics, and ethics.
Yes. That's generally the three topics in philosophy. And your worldview encompasses so much more than just philosophy, though. It's everything. It's everything from your science. I mean, science, economics, politics. Everything is informed by your worldview.
Okay. Now, this is the heart and soul of Vantillianism, and that's what we call TAG, or the Transcendental Argument for God's Existence. I know that term sounds really big and fancy, but break down on a layman level here what the Transcendental Argument is.
Well, there's a lot of debate out there on this. A Transcendental Argument... To explain a transcendental argument, I'd have to describe the form of it. And a form of a transcendental argument is something like this. And Michael Butler uses this illustration, so I'm going to shamelessly copy him. But the idea is, suppose you have a garden, right? And there's a garden with all these vegetables in it. And that's what we experience. Well, we want to ask, when we do transcendental reasoning, we want to ask, well, what are the preconditions of this garden existing? You know, obviously there had to be a gardener. There had to be seeds planted at some point. There had to be fertilizer and water, all of that. And so we can infer these things from our experience of a garden, right? But that's not really a transcendental argument. A transcendental argument, it takes that same form, but it wants to, the subject is different. So what do, for those of you who have seen The Matrix, the movie The Matrix, what we want to do is we want to defeat skepticism. You know, how do you prove you're not in The Matrix? How do you know you're not in The Matrix? You know, so what you have to do is you have to look at what you're experiencing and reason beyond what you're experiencing to preconditions the situations that make what you're experiencing intelligible. So that's what you would do. You would find a proposition that everybody agrees on. Find a proposition that everybody agrees on and say, okay, now what is the necessary precondition for this particular proposition? And you're usually talking about metaphysical truths that go beyond experience. And that's about as simple as I know how to make it.
That sounds great. Nicole Vandevent really likes your agrarian analogies.
Yeah.
Hope I pronounced your name right, Nicole Vandeventer.
I call them the Vandervees.
The Vandervees? That sounds good.
Yeah.
A lot of people think that Vantillians are fittists or fetists, that they're against the use of evidences. Is this true? Are presuppositional apologetics against the use of evidences?
Absolutely not. And that's a problem that presuppositionalists are confronted with all the time. People say, well, you don't want to use evidences. Well, you know what? We do use evidences all the time. We're concerned about the proper framework, the proper cognitive environment in which evidences are useful.
Right. How did Van Til synthesize Kuiper and Warfield? This, the whole common ground question.
Yeah. So obviously I've already said a little bit about Kuiper. He was this powerhouse theologian, but he did have his weaknesses. And one of his weaknesses was he believed that Christians, we could never have any kind of talk outside of our system, right? Christianity talked about Christian things, and that's it. Christians had to have our own version of science. Christians had to have our own version of politics, on and on and on. B.B. Warfield was a great, another powerhouse theologian over at Princeton in America. And Warfield had a different approach. He wanted to take, he said, we had a lot of common ground with unbelievers, and he wanted to use apologetics to lay this sort of empirical groundwork and then work up the theology. So to put it in layman's terms, Kuiper would say there is no common ground. Warfield says there's way too much common ground. And so Van Til wants to come along and say, we need just the right amount of common ground, you know, in theological terms, though.
So he was the synthesizer between Kuiper and Warfield. We talked about presuppositionalism and TAG, the transcendental argument, and if we could just reset the differences between presuppositionalism and the other methodologies before we continue. How does Vantillianism differ from the other stuff?
Sure. Something I should have said earlier, talking about TAG, and this will help answer the question you just asked. There is no one transcendental argument for the existence of God. There is no the transcendental argument. There's a lot of different formulations of the what Van Til was trying to do. So how is this different from what all these other people are trying to do? I mean, we can get back to Bonston's distinction here between traditionalist apologetic methodologies and presuppositionalism. So what we want to do is start by presupposing God. I mean, that we will not yield our belief in God. Don't do it. That's a sin. That really is a sin. When you try to, intellectual autonomy is basically spitting in the eye of God. And what we do not want to do is yield our belief. So we begin with this. We begin by saying we live in a Christian theistic universe, and we're not going to pretend like we don't live in a Christian theistic universe. And that's what the evidentialist apologists want to do. And I used to do it as well when I did evidentialist apologetics. You know, there's a sense you want to pretend. You want to tell the unbeliever, let's just pretend none of this is true. Let's just pretend that, you know, the world, that, you know, I don't believe in God. You're not an atheist. Let's just be neutral and let's see where the facts will lead us. And we don't want to do that as presuppositionalists. That's what makes this school different from the others.
Right. We've mentioned Van Til and Bonson. Who are some other adherents to presuppositionalism, both past and present?
Gosh, I think the biggest one that's had the biggest effect on me would be R.J. Rushdoony. And we can talk about him later when it comes to how to practically apply Van Til. But Rushdoony is just, I've listened to so many hours of that man. I'm starting to have like an impression of Rushdoony. You know, like, God is one, you know, and then, but
that's
I love
good.
Rushdoony to death.
I like that.
Yeah. I'm going to do a whole sermon with that voice.
You know, one thing I'm guilty of is I've not listened to a whole lot of Rushdoony And simply because the monotone voice puts me to sleep. But I guess I've listened to other monotone guys. I've read a book by him, and I've listened to a couple things, but I just can't. So dry. But I know his stuff is golden. But maybe I need to press through, right?
Oh, I definitely think it'd be worth it. He's had a lot of influence on me personally in my thinking.
Our friend Mickey Henry, by the way, has a bookstore that sells Rush Dooney material, and that's EmptyTombBooks.com, online bookstore. So check that out.
Great. Good deal. But some other presuppositionalists obviously would be famous John Frame and Vern Poitras. You often hear people talk about the Frame-Poitras team up because they complement each other quite a bit in their work. So they've done a lot of practical application of Vantillian thought. Poitras just came out with a book on sociology. He's got a book on science. He's got a book on hermeneutics and language. So they really want to take Van Til and apply him to academic disciplines. You got James Anderson. He's another great writer writing right now, defending presuppositional methodology. You've got the Westminster guys. You've got K. Scott Oliphant, which is probably one of my favorite presuppositionalists right now. And some other lesser lights out there. But
Neil Desperandum says that he likes monotone speakers. So how about you and I speak in monotone the remaining of the show?
I thought I had been.
Okay, Scott Terry is our guest here on Tribal Theocrat Live. Scott, what are some differences in the presuppositionalist school? I'm kidding. We don't have to do that for
Neil.
We're going to bring Neil Desperandum on here in about half an hour to let him pick your brain, Scott. But talk about Carnell and Schaefer and some differences between Van Til guys.
I like to say Vantillian just because people think it sounds like a reptile or an insect or something. You know, yeah, I'm a Vantillian.
Vantillian, that's the word I was looking for. I said Van Til guys. Whatever.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, other than the people I mentioned, presuppositionalism isn't doing so well in the world right now. It's kind of living and surviving on the popular level, but there's not a lot of academic work being done out there. So now there's a lot of work being done that Van Til would appreciate and that we can appropriate as Vantillians, but there's not a lot of self-professed, you know, I am a presuppositionalist and I am a philosophy of religion professor, and I'm doing work and writing books. There's not a lot of people like that out there. But that wasn't always the case. So if we look into history, there's a lot of people who've been influenced by Van Til in the Presbyterian Church and in the Reform movement at large. Most of them, I hate to say, and I have a lot of respect for some of these guys, but most of them are completely irrelevant now. You know, you go into a chat room and or on a forum, or if you go to a college at a debate and you talk to people in the audience afterwards, nobody says, "Oh, I wonder what Francis Schaefer would make of this." You know, nobody knows who Francis Schaefer is anymore, hardly, right. At least out in the real world. Nobody knows who Carnell is. I've never sat around scratching my noggin thinking, I wonder if Carnell could help me out of this deep personal religious problem I have. Nobody knows who Carnell is. Dr. Bonson has critiques of Carnell. He's got critiques of Dooyeweerd and Francis Schaefer. He's got a new book put out by American Vision called just Presuppositional Apologetics, I think.
Who does?
And that has essays in the back of it critiquing these people.
Scott?
Dr. Greg Bonson.
Oh, yes. I think that was edited by Joel
Sherman, yes. Yeah. Is published posthumously, obviously, yeah. Based on a lot of Bonson's old notes.
Yeah. Is your audio player playing in the background, Scott?
Yes, it is. Can you hear it?
You're a bad boy, man. Knock it off. I heard my voice.
Apologize. I was leaning too close to it, I guess.
Don't make me come down there.
Yeah. Bring it.
Gordon Clark.
Now, Gordon Clark would be an exception to everything I just said about these older guys. Gordon Clark, if you read a Clarkian, Gordon Clark was like the greatest philosopher who ever lived. But really, I actually think that, I mean, he did have a lot of influence. I was cleaning out my old preacher's, he had a bunch of books at the church, and I was cleaning it out, and I found A Christian View of Men and Things. And I was like, wow, this Arminian preacher that I grew up with in a fundamentalist household had Gordon Clark. You know, it was kind of ironic. But I definitely think we need to keep our poker face on when we talk about Gordon Clark. And
poker face?
An allusion to Lady Gaga for Mr. Cottrell.
Oh, I have no idea.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to read the chat. But so Gordon Clark, I think Kenneth should take Gordon Clark seriously. I love Gordon Clark. This is odd for a Vantillian, but I love Gordon Clark. His sense of humor is outrageous. It really is. I mean, I love the man's sense of humor. And he's very clear. I don't think there's any doubt that he was the better philosopher than Van Til. He was certainly a better writer, a better speaker, much more clarifying language. I believe he happened to be wrong about some of these epistemological and theological issues. And not just wrong, but very wrong. And but anyway, we need to take him seriously as Kenneth, because he's got some interesting views of anthropology. He thinks man is he's got this propositional man view that I think we need to interact with, and frankly, I think we need to refute. But it's interesting nonetheless, and I love Clark. But I've met like four Clarkians in real life, and like three of them have been black guys, you know, and one of them was like a rapper.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
You didn't happen to pursue that, did you?
Well, yeah, we got into like a rap battle over Gordon Clark.
Really?
We did.
Wow.
But,
you know, I just so happened to have an audio clip of you rapping about Gordon Clark. Maybe we'll play that later.
Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah.
It depends if it's how good you are. If you have the audio player up in the background again, it's over.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm going to play it. But
but Gordon Clark's great, and we need to pay attention to him. But I don't think we need to pay attention to him that much.
Okay.
You know, I certainly, I don't want to step on any toes by saying that. By the way,
so let's take a vote in the chat room. Who wants to hear Scott rapping about Gordon Clark? So far, a lot of people want it.
I don't think you guys want to hear that.
I think they want it, man.
Oh, wow.
Let's talk about John Frame, Vern Poitras. Are there differences there between those guys and Greg Bahnsen?
They got in a fairly well-known debate of Dr. Bahnsen and Dr. Frame. And in looking back on it, I think they were kind of talking past each other, unfortunately. And I love both of these guys. I mean, Dr. Bahnsen influenced me very much. And you know, looking back on it in hindsight, I can say stuff like this. But it's because of these debates that I think we have clarity today. So I appreciate them. But Frame, it seemed like John Frame made some statements in his book, Apologetics to the Glory of God, which is an awesome book, by the way. Every presuppositionalist should have it. But he made some statements that seemed like he thought presuppositionalism was only a matter of difference in methodology. For instance, an evidentialist would start with you know, the cosmological argument, let's say. But then in the end, he would admit that he was presupposing God the whole time, maybe. Whereas a presuppositionalist would say, well, we're going to start by making it clear that we're presupposing God, but really we're, and then we might go on to use some of these arguments. So in Frame's mind, at least it seemed that way to Dr. Bahnsen, Frame thought it was a methodological problem. And Dr. Bahnsen said, no, it's not methodological. It doesn't matter when you use your argument, at what point in time you use your argument. There's a fundamental qualitative difference between what we're doing. We're assuming formally assuming different epistemological positions. And so they kind of butted heads, but they're both excellent. I think they agreed a whole lot more than they disagreed.
Before we get into some practical goodies and the application part, which I know Kerry Culligan really wants to hear, let's talk about Alvin Plantinga. What can you say about him? Is he a presuppositionalist? What is he?
He is certainly not a presuppositionalist, at least in the Vantillian sense. If we loosely apply the word presuppositional, we could probably call him one. Plantinga has revolutionized contemporary philosophy of religion. He really has. He's made it to where Christians can come out of their closet and be proud to be Christians again. And he's got this whole theory of knowledge that he's basically put him on the map. He helped develop it with Nicholas Walterstorff. And there's a whole group of people that are calling themselves Reformed epistemologists. And the problem is, it's not... I mean, I think there's some problems with it, but right now in philosophy and even in debates, if you go into a chat room or if you go into a web forum, if you go to your university where there's debates going on, the big thing right now is Plantinga. Everybody wants to talk about warranted true belief. Everybody's talking about that, even atheists. I had an atheist just this week tell me that he said, "Scott, do you know Plantinga, right, Scott?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I'm just like Plantinga, just without God. That's my position. My position is just like Plantinga, just without God." And I'm thinking, you wouldn't ever hear somebody say that about Cornelius Van Til. Yeah. It'd be nonsensical. What if someone said, "Scott Terry, my position is just like Van Til, only without God."
Yeah.
Well, you can't even say that. But anyway, that's the nature of Plantinga's system. I don't want to undermine what they've done. I do have some criticisms. I don't want to accept it uncritically, and I think we need to weigh everything with Scripture before we accept it.
Got it. Application. Are all Christians... Hey, Scott.
Yeah.
I heard my voice in the background.
I don't know why that's happening.
What are you doing, man? Do you like to hear yourself in the background or something?
I apologize.
It's okay. Are all Christians called to defend the faith, or are specific Christians gifted with a special... apologetic spiritual gift?
Well, I think everybody is called to give an answer for why they believe in God. But I don't think that means everybody needs to wage this sort of warfare that I was talking about in the first part of the show. Not everybody is called to be a professional philosopher. Not everybody's called to be a professional soldier. You know, so I don't think everybody needs to be out there reading Plantinga and reading Bonson and doing that, you know, really researching and putting into the God haters. These people are genocidal maniacs that we're fighting against. And I don't think that's the job of like a housewife or something. I wouldn't want my mom out there doing it. But but now my mom is the archetypical Christian lady. She'll look at them and say, you know, you can say all these reasons.
Yeah.
You can have all these reasons, but you know what? I love God. I love God.
Yep.
And I just love him. And so that's her answer, and I think that's perfect. That's if you want to call that apologetics, that's great. And so I do think we're all called to have a response, but I don't think we're all called to formally do it. Not everybody's a loser like I am. You know, I spend quite a bit of time debating people on these issues. So, but I don't think everybody should.
Okay, I'm going to bring on Nicole to ask a question for you.
Oh,
you.
No.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, no.
She's going to be gentle.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, goodness.
Scott, can you hear Nicole?
Yes, I can.
Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. What's your question for Scott Terry?
Actually, I don't have a question, Scott. I just wanted to do a shout-out to myself.
Go for it. That's the first self shout-out on Tribal Theocrat Live. I like
it. That's really funny. I'm not normally like this, but Scott has this thing about shout-outs, and I've known Scott for years.
Yeah, we like shout-outs. Any more shout-outs?
No, none. I told you I really don't have a lot to contribute to this because I don't really know enough names. That's why I'm enjoying listening to the program and kind of learning everything.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
My
husband will have a lot more to say.
Absolutely. I look forward to having him on.
Thank you.
Take care.
All right. You too. Bye.
Well, she chose a good program to listen to. I mean, not specifically this episode, but just Tribal Theocrat in general. I think what you're doing is an excellent contribution to the world.
I appreciate it, Scott. It means a lot. I do what I can.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about natural law. That's a big topic, and it's a big topic in general with Christian theology, but it's specifically a point of concern whenever we talk about different apologetic methodologies. What is the biblical view of natural law, and how do we use that as apologists?
Well, my general attitude about natural law is to pretty much just take whatever Nil Desperanda believes and just do the opposite, you know. I don't know if Nil's even listening.
Oh, he is. He's going to be grilling you in about 10 minutes, man.
You said natural law. Natural law is a subset of natural theology. And so as Reformed Christians, we believe that God reveals everything. Everything we experience is a revelation from God. And some things we experience have moral propositions attached to them. And obviously the moral propositions that we know as humans are reflections of God's nature. So there are things in nature that have moral propositions attached to them. Now we have this clarified in Scripture for us. Scripture is obviously, like as Calvin would say, the spectacles through which we view the world. But everything's revelation. So when we talk about natural law, we're talking about moral law that can be derived in some fashion or other from our surroundings.
Okay. That might be a topic you, me, and Nil can discuss here a little bit later. How about this issue of theonomy and how it pertains to presuppositionalism? And you and I agree that theonomy leads to kenism. Can you expatiate on that point, please?
Yeah, well, Cornelius Van Til showed us all how to basically reconstruct our theory of knowledge along consistently Christian lines. And when we start doing that, I mean, everything, our theory of knowledge and how we know what we know has profound influences on all other areas of academia. So from political philosophy to law to science and on and on and on to mathematics even. And what we want to do is look at something like philosophy of law and look at something like political philosophy. And we want to take these disciplines and reconstruct them along consistently Christian lines according to a consistently Christian theory of knowledge, like the one Van Til has shown us. And that leads to theonomy. Theonomy is basically a consistent application of God's revelation. There is no other standard by which we're to live. There's none other than God's nature. And God's nature has been specifically reflected in the biblical law for us. That's what law is. It's a statement of God's moral nature. And that's what we're obligated to follow. And we see that, you know, when we start reconstructing these areas of academia along consistently Christian lines.
I can hear your audio player, Scott.
That's odd. I don't know why that's doing that.
Never mind. Here, it's gone now. You and I know that there's not too many people really awake to the key issues today where the fire rages, but there are kinists, and there's a group called White Nationalists, and they are in some sense comrades, but we do have to persuade them eventually to come into the faith. How do we do that? How do we argue presuppositionally with the White Nationalist community?
That's something I'm very passionate about doing. I want to be kind of like St. Patrick, you know, who goes in and talks to the pagans and just wins everybody. At least I daydream about it. I know I probably won't be able to do it, but I've spent a lot of time with a lot of different people in the racially aware community in America, from white nationalists, skinheads, Klan members, Christian identity people, all the way up to the suit and tie wearing people who attend American Renaissance conferences. And I've divided everybody into kind of two arbitrary groups. And one of them is a group that is really influenced by the Enlightenment thought. And these are the people that I would, you know, that I would class with all those people that Dabney would say just can't be reasoned with. They are, thoroughly anti-Christian. They hate the entire concept of God. So I don't even, I try to avoid those guys. But there's another group with the traditionalists. They might be pagans. They might be sincerely looking for some sort of truth in life, and they might be open to genuine, discussion. And these are the people that I want to talk to and say, hey, we have got something here. We have got a reason to live. We have got a reason to fight for our racial identity. And we've got all these things. They're not just arbitrary. They're not just nihilistic desires in some sort of impersonal mechanistic universe that we're trying to impose on everybody, because that's ridiculous. No, we have word from the living God telling us that we need to be proud of our family. We need to love everyone because we love him. And we love our families, I mean, because we love him. And so it fleshes out the movement, I think, Kenism does. And in that respect, I think the North American New Right needs Kenism. They desperately need a heart and soul to their movement, because right now they're just kind of soulless and wandering around lost.
I agree. I really like that exchange between the administrator of Spirit, Water, Blood and Alex Linder. You can find that on spiritwaterblood.com. Just search for Alex Linder, and there was a great exchange in the comment section. I think an entire post dedicated to, I think it's called A Response to Alex Linder, but there's some good issues brought up there, and that's where we really see the difference.
I definitely say that
us.
Spirit, Water, Blood is like the balls of the Kenneth movement. You know? Can I say that on this?
Well, you just did. Spiritwaterblood.com is by far the best Kenneth site out there, and I'm going to try to run him down someday to get him on here. Very good site. I'm not quite sure how he writes that way, but wonderful writer, and those posts are just amazing to read. It's meat.
I've actually heard that the reason he doesn't want to come on the radio is because he's actually a black man. So
I bet you're right there. He could be a Negro.
Well, see, that was what I heard. You guys, Neil Desperandum had this theory that I was a Negro the last time he was on your show, and I just wanted to
that could be
I,
true,
I just
Scott.
Want everybody to know I'm only half Negro and only 10% Jewish. So
I've never seen you. I have seen Neil. I can vouch for him. He's safe, but we're not so sure about you. Let's get into a few nerdy questions, and we'll go through this quickly, and then we'll bring on Neil to have some dialogue. How important is epistemology? I heard Van Til talk a lot about being epistemologically self-conscious. What does that mean to be epistemologically self-conscious? Self-conscious?
Yeah, when Dr. Bronson spoke at Westminster during the Van Til seminar, he kind of said that epistemological self-consciousness is a presuppositional buzzword. So he was kind of snapping his fingers saying, yeah, we need to talk about epistemological self-consciousness, yeah. And but all it means, it's a big, big phrase. Epistemology, of course, as we've already said, is the theory of knowledge. And self-consciousness, obviously, you want to be self-consciously aware. When you have a debate with someone, you want to know what your underlying theory of knowledge is. You want to have that firmly in mind, and you want to make him your opponent. You want to force him to be epistemologically self-conscious as well. So what that means is we want to find our ultimate presuppositions, that one belief that we really hold very strongly emotionally, that is immune from a revision, as Dr. Bonson would say. It has revisionary immunity, and we want to find that belief, and we want to just attack it on our opponent. And deconstruct it. So that's what epistemological self-consciousness is. It's being aware of your most ultimate belief.
Can man, as man, not as redeemed man, so can a pagan man, unregenerate man, know anything? Can he know anything?
Absolutely.
Okay.
The scriptures say that all men know some things.
All right. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, to expound on that, though, would have to, you know, get us deep into the epistemological
weeds. Yeah, okay. I think you're right. We should probably move on. It's a question that comes up in the debates between presuppositionalists and other
apologetic
methodologies.
We get that all the time. People say Van Til claimed that you can't know anything. The unbeliever can't know anything.
Right.
Alvin Plantinga even said that. Dr. Bronson tells the story that he's eating lunch, you know, with Alvin Plantinga, and Plantinga sat there, looked him square in the face, and said, Van Til said, you know, if Van Til is right in what he's saying, then the unbeliever can't know anything. Well, Dr. Yeah. Bronson said, for somebody so brilliant as Alvin Plantinga to so terribly get Van Til wrong is just astounding. But that is a common complaint that presuppositionalists get. It's not true. We believe Reformed theology teaches that all men know some things.
Do you want to go into the question that I was going to ask you about knowledge? Is knowledge true belief with good justification? That's the standard definition. Do you believe that?
That's gone out of style, especially since Plantinga with his warranted theme. And this guy named Gettier really proposed some counterexamples. So traditionally, ever since Plato, people have been saying knowledge is justified true belief. And they would debate all three of those, you know, what does it mean to be justified? What is true and what is belief? But then Gettier comes along and has these counterexamples that I don't have time to get into, but basically showing that a person could be justified, have justified true belief, but still not have knowledge. Okay. So
Is there a real quick definition of knowledge then from your view?
Can I provide one?
Well, if knowledge is not true belief with good justification, is there a better formula for knowledge? What is knowledge?
Knowledge, I would have to lay out a Van Tilian epistemology for you, and I don't think we have time. I actually wanted to do that. I came prepared to do that tonight. But in very, very short and quick, Van Til takes Reformed theology and basically reasons from the doctrine of divine simplicity, the doctrine of the Trinity, and the doctrine of divine aseity, and he concludes that we have a noetic structure out there, and knowledge is when we correctly place facts into this noetic structure. So basically we're thinking God's thoughts after him, and that is a very frustratingly ambiguous statement that I've always, as a presuppositionalist, been frustrated with when I'd hear somebody say it, because it, you know, somebody asks you what's knowledge, and you say, oh, it's when you think God's thoughts after him. Well, what does that, the heck does that mean? I would have to lay that out, and I don't think we have time, but a Van Tilian view of knowledge is thinking God's thoughts after him.
Good enough. One more quick question before we bring on Nil Desperandum. In fact, Nil and I have discussed this. Is TAG, the transcendental argument for God's existence, is that itself a deductive argument? Some people say it is, some people say it isn't.
I think there's a lot of confusion out there on this. If it was a deductive argument, it would be called the deductive argument for the existence of God. Transcendental argumentation is itself a form of argumentation. So it's not deductive, it's not inductive, it's transcendental. And by the way, I don't even think, I side with John Frame on this, and I got this from Frame. But transcendental argument, you know, I want a bumper sticker that says TAG. It's not an argument, it's an attitude. You know, maybe I could get one of those shirts with Van Til's face on it instead of Che Guevara. It just says TAG. It's not an argument, it's an attitude.
I would love
it. Is Reformed theology in toto, is that an argument? I don't think it's an argument like that. Although we do argue transcendentally, I don't agree that we should try thinking of it as a inductive or deductive argument. It can be construed as both. I've seen Dr. Bonson do deductive forms of it and inductive forms of it. So really we're asking the wrong questions when we talk about what type of argument is it.
Okay, this is the segment where we bring on another guest to interact with you, and if anybody else has questions, you can ask those in the chat room. We'll try to take a couple of those, but we're winding down here on time. Are you open for a question, Scott?
Yeah, sure.
Excellent.
And I'm open for praises. And
yeah, anybody want to call in and just praise Scott and talk about how good looking he is or something like that, we'll go ahead and pat you on the line.
That would actually be nice.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You never know what's going to happen. Our guest on the line now is a writer for Faith and Heritage. He's been on before. His name is Neil Desperandum. Neil, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, my pleasure. What kind of interaction do you want to have with Scott? Do you have any questions? I know that you had formerly been a Vantillian. Do you want to talk about what made you leave that camp?
No, not really. I mean, I think whatever topics we'll get to talking will naturally bring up, like, whatever okay. objections I have to it will naturally be the reasons that I left.
Got
it.
Well. Yep.
My memory's really bad, too, so it's probably best to stay away from that. Well, I guess we can just stick with what was most recently discussed about the inductive-deductive thing. Scott, when you're saying that you don't think it's either inductive or deductive, but it's just a third category that's different from those two, do you mean to say that it's different in the sense that it's an attitude or that it's just a different type of syllogism that is different from inductive and deductive arguments?
Well, see, this is a common problem when people start talking about transcendental arguments, and not just with Van Til, but if you look in the secular literature of transcendental arguments as well, people are asking these sorts of questions. The leading writer right now, I think, is probably Robert Stern. He's got an anthology out of different analytical approaches to transcendental arguments, and the question is like, what is are transcendental arguments deductive or inductive or what? And people can formulate these things any way they want. Like I said, Dr. Bonson has formulated an inductive argument for transcendental argument and a deductive transcendental argument just to show that it can be done both ways. Because it's not really, it's not a direct argument like this. It's an indirect or negative argument. So, it can be presented in various different ways, like, you know, inductive, deductive, or whatever.
So you can put tag on the chalkboard as a syllogism, but that doesn't get to the real heart of what tag is.
Well, and that gets back to what I was saying that I read from Dr. James Anderson. And Dr. James Anderson always talks about this. He says, tag, there's no one transcendental argument for the existence of God. Like, you know, you could talk about the cosmological argument or the ontological argument. And sometimes people get this idea that tag is just one more argument that you can have in your back pocket. But it's not like that. It's an entire attitude, an entire way of reasoning that we specifically as Reformed believers engage in. I hope that kind of – that probably didn't scratch where you're itching, Mr. Desperandum. But
that's all right. I just wanted to hear some elaboration before going on to something else. Oh, let's see. I scribbled down some notes to remember the topics that you went over.
Do you dot your I's with hearts?
No. Microsoft Word doesn't either, so that's good. You talked about the use of evidence and how it's a mischaracterization of Vantillianism to say that Vantillians are against the use of evidence. Normally, at least when I think of that objection, it's not that – let me rephrase. When I've seen Van Til respond to that objection in the book Van Til's Apologetic, which Bonson wrote and edited, Van Til just basically says, this objection is brought up, but of course I believe in evidence. And he doesn't seem to deal with the actual argument, which tries to say, well, given that Van Til believes A, B, and C, therefore he cannot believe in evidence. And I think the best way to show that he, in fact, kind of just weak, or I should say, just evacuates all the strength out of Christian evidences is with the resurrection. Mm-hmm. Because the example Bonson liked to use was the resurrection, and he would say that even if you could prove someone rose from the dead, even prove that Jesus rose from the dead, that still would lack, you still wouldn't prove that he's the Son of God. You still wouldn't prove that he's now ascended and is at the right hand of the Father. And he thinks that there's so much lacking that just makes it utterly deficient. And that also, even if you prove that someone rose from the dead, the unbeliever could still say, ah, whatever, things happen. It's a chance universe. Anything can happen. And I'm just not sure how, if you do that, if you say that unbelievers are allowed to reinterpret anything any way they want, how could you say that any evidences at all work?
Yeah, this is obviously a common criticism of Van Til. So you've got a couple things tied up there together, so I'll try to address them one at a time. And by the way, Nathan Shannon is personally one of my favorite Van Tilian philosophers of religion that's writing right now. And he's got an article coming out on Van Til's use of evidences precisely because of this problem, especially in light of the recent analytical work that's been done. You know, Plantinga and especially Michael Sudduff, whom I know you and I are both aware of, Neil. The idea of exactly what does Van Til mean when he says that we can use evidences, or exactly what sort of context is Van Til talking about when it comes to using evidences. So Nathan Shannon has a great article coming out in this year's, I guess it's a yearly, I don't know, the most recent Westminster Theological Journal. And it compares Van Til's use of evidence with John Locke's use of evidence. And I've already got it kind of early in, I read it, and it's just an awesome, very clear piece of analytical writing on Van Til's use of evidences. And I think, I don't know how much time we have, but I really just cannot get into Van Til's epistemology right now because we don't have time. I'd love to get in and show exactly what Van Til means by a fact, exactly how these facts are strung together to make, to constitute evidence, and then exactly what all these facts and evidence, what we mean by knowledge when we take these facts and evidences together. But, I don't think we got enough time to get into that. I'd like to, but I guess to answer the question, I'd have to, for now, just direct you to the Westminster Theological Journal by Nathan Shannon, and you can download that for free from the site, and I'll post that in the chat room.
What's his name? Nathan what? It cut out on us.
Shannon?
Nathan Shannon. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, well.
That's an anticlimactic answer.
There's
I know.
A passage.
Sorry.
What'd you say? Sorry, I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. I just said that's an anticlimactic answer. I know, but
I
really want to dig into this, but we don't. I don't guess we have time.
Yeah, there's actually a passage from Van Til's Apologetic that I'm wondering to get into, but that the length of time it might take to go over it would be improper, I think. So I might just go on to a different topic. Let's see. Okay. Now, earlier you mentioned that one of the differences between presuppositionalists and classical or evidential apologists is that presuppositionalists want to say that we begin by saying we live in a Christian theistic universe, whereas evidentialists would start by pretending that Christian theism is not true and trying to be neutral in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, do you really think that's a fair construction? Because I know I would never say anything about pretending something is not true. I might say that the unbeliever, or even if the unbeliever is currently or I might just say that, you know, without establishing as a premise or without just presupposing that Christianity is true, we can still provide premises which entail Christianity's truth. And the whole point then is trying to build up that argument that way. And that seems to be the entirety of apologetics from my perspective. But that clearly doesn't mean that you lay a premise that Christianity is false. You just don't lay a premise that it's true, because that'd be circular. So the old circularity objection.
Yeah. I think, number one, I think it is a fair caricature because we have so many people, so many scholars who directly say that that's what they're trying to do, specifically Carnell, even Gordon Clark to a degree, who describes himself as a dogmatic fideist. But I mean, even just me personally, I used to do this, and I know my own thought process. So I used to sit down and say, well, now I'm talking about a formal thing here. Let's formally pretend like, you know, we're on this neutral world, that we live in or whatever. But of course, that doesn't mean that psychologically inside that I actually gave up belief in God. So I didn't want to imply that, but I do think that, a lot of people used to do that. Now today, because of the rise of planting and all that, I think we're starting to get away from that sort of thought, and thank God for that, because we're starting to see that God is going to be Lord over all areas of life, whether we want him to or not.
Okay, well, I don't really think that Planinga would even depart from that either, because Planinga still thinks that even though belief in God can be properly basic, meaning that, for our listeners at least, meaning that it can be a justified belief, we can reasonably and justifiably hold that belief, even though we don't hold it on the basis of other beliefs, on the basis of other evidences. So he believes that it can be properly basic, but he also believes that there are arguments for it.
But it doesn't have to be properly basic. It doesn't have to be for Planinga. It could, any belief could be properly basic, and he just wants to play these cute little word games, which, by the way, are clever, but he doesn't want to say that we have to presuppose God. He just wants to say that, okay, we're going to presuppose God, we believe in him, but we're warranted. And you can't say that we're not warranted, because we, you know, you have all these beliefs that aren't warranted either, the beliefs in other minds, the beliefs in, you know, that there is a past 5 seconds ago. And he points out a lot of these things, but Planinga, I was a devotee of Planinga myself for a while. I was besotted with him. But after a while, I started moving away from it. I started saying that we have an obligation to believe certain things. And that's one of the biggest things that people are contesting about Planinga's epistemology right now. There's the idea of doxastic intentionality. Can we choose to believe certain things when Scripture says that we have an obligation to believe certain things? They don't just... You know, we can't say that certain beliefs just pop into our minds as properly basic and let it go at that, because scripture says we're obligated to believe certain things. And there's other critiques, but I'm moving towards in my epistemology, Neil, I'm moving away from this and moving back towards a sort of divine command theory of justification, internalism, and, you know, deontological, duty. I think we're obligated to go that direction as Christians, because that's what Scripture, that's what I'm concerned with, is what Scripture says, and how do we work this out with our theology?
Okay, well, you listed divine command theory for justification and internalism and a deontological view justification, and I can at least say I agree with the third one, so that's good news. Now, you mentioned for Planinga, you said something about properly basic beliefs kind of popping up, and then Christians can claim that, and they can, according to what you say Planinga argues, Christians can just say, well, too bad, atheists. I mean, the belief popped up in my head, so I'm justified in believing it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's also really a proper characterization of Planinga. He mentions what he calls the great pumpkin objection.
Yes,
and that's the
yes.
objection that if we can say belief in God is properly basic, then why can't we say belief in the great pumpkin is properly basic? Or basically yeah. anything, belief in invisible pink elephants. And the point that he makes is that, you know, just as we have certain sensory beliefs which are properly basic, like the belief that a computer is in front of me, I see a computer, I form that because of a particular experience, which is the ground for that belief. Mm-hmm. It's not evidence in the sense that it's a proposition mm-hmm. underlying the belief, but it's an experience, a non-propositional experience. And he would say that there's a sort of connection between these non-propositional experiences and properly basic beliefs, and that we have duties with respect to those connections, and we can't just arbitrarily claim things about it.
Yeah.
And as a side note, I think that actually makes an argument for the existence of God, but I won't go there now. But if we want to say that we have duties with respect to forming properly basic beliefs in given circumstances, then on Planinga's system, you can totally say that everyone is obligated to believe in God's properly basic belief. There are certain things, given our non-propositional experiences, that we ought to believe, and certain things which are not grounded in that experience.
I can hear some feedback from one of you two losers, so just make sure your audio players are turned down. But let's go for a couple more minutes, and then we'll need to wrap up. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I have, you know, I understand planning a system. I'm not an expert at planning a system, but I to me it just seems like we're in this defeater free for all, You know, you want to talk about pumpkins, it's like defeater, the pumpkin eater or something. You know, that's what I always think about, think of planting it. But, there's no reason that we need to make God a properly basic belief. It's just the same arbitrary, the same autonomous reasoning. And now a lot of Van Tillians are besotted with planting it. I don't want to make any definitive statements. You know, I'm still, like I said, I love planting it for a long time, and now I'm kind of moving away to a more internalist deontological, position. But, you know, so I'm not really prepared to deconstruct a planting it like epistemology right now. Although I will again direct you to another article by Nathan Shannon, on this, the problem of doxastic intentionality in planting a system. And by the way, another good author is Ronnie Murad, who wrote Transcendental Arguments and Justified Christian Belief. And I was interested in that. Obviously, Murad tries to show that transcendental arguments can be useful within planting as epistemological scheme. And he points out the same doxastic intentionality problem, and he tries to use transcendental arguments to get around it. But I don't think he does very well with it. Because, you know, I'm just a farm boy from North Carolina. I practice apologetics, you know, but I'm not as interested in the debates about it, really.
Well, we'll give Neil Deese Brandon the last word, and then we'll boot him off. How's that?
It's fine.
Go ahead, Neil.
That's fine. Okay. Well, Scott, you said that you don't think presuppositionalists should think that belief in God is a properly basic belief, but I mean, even if you don't want to go with all the details of Plantinga's view of warrant and justification, and warrant, by the way, for the listeners, that's basically the same as knowledge. It's just it's not exactly knowledge, but it basically refers to knowledge. So his views of knowledge and justification. Because presuppositionalists want to say that, you know, we don't want to conclude in God or conclude our belief in God at the end of an argument, but we should hold that as kind of a pre-theoretical commitment. It's a presuppositional commitment. And in that sense, you'd hope that that would be a basic belief. It would not be held on the basis of other beliefs. It would also be justifiably held. People would be doing what they ought to do if they hold it. So it would be a properly basic belief. So yes. I would assume that at least in that broad sense, presuppositionalists would agree that God belief is properly basic.
And, absolutely.
Yeah, and the other point then I'd like to make before finishing up is that even if we say that belief in God is properly basic, that doesn't mean there can't also be arguments for it. And this is why Plantinga also believes in various theistic arguments, because let me give an example.
He does a lot of work on the ontological argument too, Plantinga does.
Yeah, that'd be one. But I'm just thinking of an argument that doesn't have to do with belief in God. Like, suppose that it's Christmas morning and you're sleeping in your bed and your kids jump up, come in the bed and jump, and they tell you it's snowing outside. And so on that basis, you form the belief that it's snowing. Your children have testimony, and then that's a premise, and the conclusion is, oh, it's snowing outside. Now suppose you get up and you look out the window and you see it's snowing outside. And so you have not only this this non-basic belief that it's snowing because supported by your children's testimony, but you also have the sensory information that's supporting the belief. So you have belief in your children's testimony supporting your belief that it's snowing outside, and you have the non-propositional experience of seeing snow, and that also supports your belief that it's snowing outside. And so your belief that it's snowing outside would be properly basic because it would be grounded by the experience, but it also would have evidence, you might say, for it, because your children told you. And it could be a similar thing with belief in God, where we not only are justified in believing in him as a properly basic belief, but there are also arguments which bolster that with additional propositional fortification, you can call it, premises. And that's the general framework that Plantinga has when he also offers arguments for the existence of God. And I think that's the generally correct answer to not reject theistic arguments that way, but also not to reject that theistic belief is properly basic.
Yeah, now, and that sounds like everything you just said. I mean, I want to clap my hands and say congratulations, you're arguing like a presuppositionalist now. And this is exactly like what we see in, and I know you're familiar with Michael Suttoth's book, his infamous chapter 8 now, where he talks about dogmatic natural theology. And that's exactly what we want to do. And Van Til talks about, dogmatic natural theology, beta or bravo or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
So Van Til wants to reformulate these traditional arguments and make sure that we're not intellectually autonomous when we use the cosmological argument or when we use the ontological argument. And Dr. Bahnsen in his course on the philosophy of religion he spends days, entire class episodes, formulating these traditional theistic arguments along consistently Christian lines. So I think there's a lot that we can inform, the planting, and the presuppositionalist guys have a lot that they can help each other out with. But I want to be very careful. I don't disagree with what you said about Warrant, but I think we need to be clear that when Plantinga talks about knowledge, he says, well, knowledge is warranted true belief, right? But they don't know that about knowledge. They believe that there's the sensus divinitatis. This is knowledge that God implants in us automatically, right? But how does the warranted true belief motif account for the sensus divinitatis knowledge that we have? And how, is that warranted true belief? Obviously it's not. So there's problems here. What do I think it is?
No. Why wouldn't you think it is warranted true belief? I would assume that, if God designed us, to respond to His revelation in nature and to form belief in Him, given that experience, then we would be justified in forming it, and we would be properly functioning as we form it, to use Plantinga's phrasing. And so warranted and true in belief, so it'd be knowledge.
This is a difference that Plantinga had and that Michael Suttoth, I think, corrected in his book, because Plantinga said that, in reference to Romans 1, we only have a capacity for knowledge that when we actually get out into the world, we can use this warranted true belief motif to account for what we know, through the sensus divinitatis. But, Suttoth says no. I mean, scripture, and I rented Suttoth's book from the library for a while and I didn't have a chance to study it as much as I would like. I'd like to go back and read this part to clarify it, but it seems like Suttoth says, no, this is actual knowledge that we have immediately. As Calvin says, as soon as we open our eyes, we have this knowledge. So that I don't see any, anywhere. And by the way, I don't see anywhere how that could be justified by this warranted true belief motif. And, Furthermore, the idea that warrant has – it's like they're always very tentative when they talk about warrant. It's that idea that enough of which – what do you mean enough of which? I don't think they have a very good idea of what knowledge is at all. I think they just have this concept, this mechanism, but no real quantifiable data to fill it in with.
Quick response, Neil, and we need to wrap up.
Yeah, I'll let you have the last.
I'll just respond on the warrant thing. When philosophers talk about that, I think they're purposely vague because they want to give a category such that warrant a true belief is by definition knowledge, and then they can say, okay, we've established this category, and it might be quantitative. There might be degrees of it that you need. It might be more all or nothing thing, maybe more qualitative, you might say. But by definition, warrant is whatever is the difference between true belief and knowledge. And people can provide different answers for that. And Plantinga's answer, of course, has to do with proper functioning. Oh, and I also disagree with his interpretation of Romans 1, though I don't think it has much bearing on his particular views of warrant and justification.
We couldn't really go further until we just were really able to crawl down into the weeds on our differences in the epistemology there. But
we could talk for hours.
Yeah. Can I make one quick point, though, about all this? And
sure.
Just take a step back and – I would say that still, whatever the epistemology might be, still I think presuppositionalism as a method is probably the best. I mean, if a guy says, I don't think Jesus really rose from the dead, right? I would as a presuppositionalist I would say, well, you know what? You can't prove 2 seconds ago happened, so I'm not going to listen to anything you have to say about history until you can prove it. And he can't do it. But now if I was an evidentialist or arguing, you know, I would have to start by saying, well, you know, there's a cause, you know, argue cosmologically, then say, well, now this cause, this infinite theistic God, you know, there's just this long string of arguments I would have to make. Whereas a presuppositionalist, I just say, hey, you can't prove 2 seconds ago existed, so why should I listen to anything you have to say about history? So I think presuppositionalism, despite whatever methodological issues we could have, is still the best in terms of practical apologetics. Just for those people who don't want to have all those debates, you just want to cut to the short of it. But anyway.
Hey, Neil Desbrandon, thanks for calling up, man.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you again for having me on.
My pleasure.
Right, have a good night, guys.
You too. Well, by popular request, we're going to play the Gordon Clark rap song. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Oh, no.
Yo, listen up. Sometimes when one man lives in the shadow of another man, the man gets jealous. He starts thinking that he could be just as good of an apologist as Van Til. Maybe I can form my own apologetic system. Maybe I can have people come listen to me when I teach. Maybe. But I'm gonna tell you, Christian theory of knowledge can't beat the presupposition. Here we go.
Scripturalism. Philosophers forming a trivial system. They sing syllogisms instead of the word of the man who's risen. Like Aristotle was better than Christ and the apostles. The Bible's consistent, all other systems impossible. But this system's arisen from maxim the vision. Impossible passion caught lacking a vision. He can't see that Van Til was the only one still standing on the word like light shine on a hill. Come on, Gordon Clark, get real.
Yo, listen up.
Good job,
no,
Scott.
Man, once was enough.
Once was enough. That was said in loop
That's like
mode.
The worst thing I've ever heard in my life.
I think it was great. Let's wrap up the show.
That was way back before I was really self-conscious in my Kenneth views.
It's all good.
Terrible.
Before we wrap up, what are some recommended resources for our listeners in terms of getting a handle on apologetics and presuppositional apologetics?
Listen to all the introductory courses by Bonson that you can find. He's really the best when it comes to audio, but his books I found are kind of hard to understand. They're written as an analytical philosophy text instead of, you know, and so, but the best book, I think, the one that really introduced me to Van Til would be Rushdoony's book, By What Standard? And people always dismiss Rushdoony because, oh, he's a theonomist. We don't want to talk about him. But if you, he really had a good handle on Van Tilian apologetics. So Rushdoony, John Frame's book, Cornelius Van Til, An Analysis of His Thought, is probably the second. I mean, it's really an excellent text. And anything by K. Scott Oliphant. Oliphant is really, he's the professor of apologetics at Westminster right now. And he's an excellent, excellent writer, excellent speaker, very clear thinker. And he would, for those of you who are lost in all that talk about planning and all that, he would lay out the groundwork of contemporary analytical philosophy from a uniquely Christian perspective, I think, that would be very helpful for everyone.
Well, thanks so much, Scott, Terry, for coming on the show to talk about this. And we have a show coming up December 15th with John McGregor. That will be on conspiracies. That's going to be a really good show. I think all of our people, both our people and our faith, need to get a handle on our out-of-control government and find out about the topic of conspiracy. So we'll have that, and then in January, I think it's January 3rd, the first Saturday of January, we'll have a special guest on to talk about National Socialism and Hitler's Third Reich. So again, another barn burner show coming up soon. And thank you for everyone who participated in the chat room, and thanks to Nicole Vandeventer, who came on and gave herself a self-indulgent shout-out. That was good. And a special thanks to Neil Desperandum, who came on and interacted with our friend Scott Terry. That's all we have for today. We will see you next time for more. Thanks for joining.